has come. I've got to face facts. I need to wear glasses now when I preach. So I'm actually inviting us all to reflect on moments when we felt a bit old, especially if you engaged with young people and you've had that experience of not really understanding what they're doing or what they're on about. As a teacher, I have that experience on a daily basis. And the latest thing that I don't get about young people is the bottle flipping craze, which some of you may be across. And as a result of a few YouTube videos that have been put up, they've gone viral. And a trend amongst young people, and certainly the young people I work with, is to get a half-filled plastic drink bottle, half-filled with water, and to try and flip it so it lands upright. And that's great if you can do it individually, but even better if you can get a whole group of you in a circle, do it at once, and see how many you can get up. I can see some of you already thinking this is a great idea, we need to get on board with this. Me personally, I don't quite understand what the appeal is with this. And in schools now, it's quite common practice to bring drink bottles to class legitimately so you can have a glass of water, a drink of water, but of course the encouragement to bottle flip in the middle of the lesson is there, and I just don't get what the attraction is. I don't know if you've had this experience in church of feeling a bit old, when young people have done something in church that you just didn't get. I kind of expected that eventually I'd have that kind of experience, but I must admit I didn't expect to have it when I was in my mid-20s. There's an annual Christian youth event that happens in Sydney called Black Stump, and it's still going. And in its heyday, about 7,000 young people from around Australia came together to hear bands and speakers. And the first time I went to Black Stump, it was just one of those really amazing experiences. Being there with so many Christians who are really passionate about God, it was fantastic. And every morning would open with a time of worship we'd share together, and thousands of people come together. It was just fantastic. And when we first went to Black Stump, the music was led by Jeff Bullock, who some of you will remember as the original worship leader at Hillsong. And he wrote such Christian classics as Power of Your Love and Refresh My Heart. And they were new songs in those days. Well, my friends and I regularly made pilgrimages up to Black Stump. And this particular year, the worship wasn't being led by Hillsong. It was led by Youth Alive from Sydney. And they all came on stage and they looked pretty young and dynamic, and they launched into the first worship song, which is a song that I'd never heard before. And the words of this song stuck with me, so I can still remember it today, but the words went something like this. I serve the man with the plan. I serve the man with the plan. I serve the man. I serve the man. I serve the man with the plan. And it wasn't so much sung, but shouted. And each time the phrase, I serve the man, was said, it was yelled out with a bit more volume and intensity. And as this started, I was thinking, what on earth is going on? And then the band kicked in, and then everyone started jumping up and down on the spot. And I don't know if you've had that experience of being part of a large crowd, but feeling like you're not fitting in at all with what's going on, and that's exactly what I felt. I didn't know the song, and I couldn't get into this sort of worship, so I found myself drifting to the side, grabbing a bit of grass, watching the crowd sort of doing this worship moshing and feeling very old indeed. Well, part of coming to church, we naturally like to feel comfortable. Familiar surrounds, familiar people, familiar service format, familiar songs. Churches are often not that good at doing new things, especially Anglican churches. Our reading today from the Psalms is about singing a new song. And as we reflect in our season of praise, our reading invites us to consider how we can let God do new things in our lives and new things in our churches. Now, you don't need me to tell you that this, in this day and age, the church faces considerable challenges. How do we stay true to what we're on about and our teachings, which are hundreds of years old, and yet stay relevant and engaging in a rapidly changing contemporary society? This is not an easy thing to do by any means. It's a real challenge and it impacts many facets of church life, and it can often generate a lot of heat around the issue of music. I'm old enough to remember the great controversy that erupted over the introduction of the overhead projector in church. Those of you of my vintage may remember this device, which allowed the words of a song to be projected up onto the walls of the church. Despite the seeming simplicity of this device, it did require a skilled operator. And if you can remember the introduction of the overhead projector, I'm sure you can remember, like I can, services where the words were projected upside down and around the wrong way and trying to get your head around what was being sung. It kind of seems funny now to look back on it, but the introduction of the overhead projector was met with some strong resistance in Anglican churches, and because I was working with youth at the time and trying to move with the times and all that sort of stuff, I've actually kept articles that were written in our church newspaper, the Melbourne Anglican, where people are writing in saying, this is really the thin edge of the wedge, the sign the church has completely lost its way, the introduction of the overhead projector. Why were they so upset? Well, in their view, one of the key markers of Anglican services and Anglican worship was that it was orderly. And order was maintained through the use of two books, the prayer book and the hymn book. With the invention of the overhead projector, the traditional greeting when you walked into an Anglican church, traditionally in an Anglican church, you were greeted by getting a whole lot of books. You were given a prayer book and a hymn book and off you went. And some people were also concerned that if you were no longer holding a hymn book when you were singing, so you had your hands here, but if you weren't now, because the words were on the church wall, your hands are kind of free to do what, and they, you know, they might start drifting up heavenward in acts of worship. And this was considered a very worrying development for those Anglicans who are unsure if the Holy Spirit really was a welcome presence in our churches. Well, in the age of the data projector, this controversy about the overhead projector seems a bit silly, but it does go to the heart of what is actually quite a profound problem. How to hold on to what is central and important, yet have the flexibility to move with the times. Music is just the edge of a much deeper issue. How do we stay open to letting God do new things? And in our own Anglican church, we're profoundly and deeply divided over this, over the question of what are you free to let go of, and what do you really need to hang on to? So one arm of our Anglican church argues that what can't be changed is our theology and our ethics. But our worship, we're free to move with the times. But another group within our church argues that no, it's the traditions of the church that need to be held on, and we can't change our worship because that maintains the continuity, but our theology and our ethics, they're the things that need to move with the times. Part of the challenge is that all of us have a natural tendency to theologize our personal preferences. And by that I mean we tend to think that what we like, God likes also. I barrack for Essendon and have an Essendon pencil case that my daughter's brought me as a Father's Day gift. And I use, it's a nice big pencil case, so I use this pencil case to carry around all my stuff to classes when I teach at school. And boys at school are particularly attuned to what football team you barrack for. And you know, here it is, I'm advertising it quite explicitly with my Essendon pencil case. And then the kids naturally ask me when they see that I barrack for Essendon, they ask the question, why do you barrack for Essendon? And my normal response is, because God barracks for Essendon. And I deliver it with a straight, I'm a bit practiced at this, so I deliver it with a straight face, and at first they think I must be being serious, but then they soon work out I'm not. However, I do feel that when the game is close, and especially when we're playing Carlton, that God is on Essendon's side. I can see this argument has been more challenging to maintain in recent years, with all that's gone on with the supplement scandal, but I am of the view that God barracks for Essendon. He favours Australia in the cricket, especially the Ashes, and has a special place in his kingdom for people with no hair. Well, with these examples, it's perhaps a bit obvious to see what's going on. I'm assuming that God likes what I like. We all have a tendency to do this, and we take it much more seriously when it comes to church. If we like traditional hymns, then we tend to be of the view that this is what God likes also. God likes great words, strong theology, and improper rhymes every now and again. We tend to view modern choruses with some suspicion. We feel that God's not really a fan of loud music, drums, and amplified sound in general. But if you like choruses, then you feel that this is what God likes also. God loves modern upbeat tunes with catchy words. God doesn't like mouldy old hymns that were written 100 years ago. God likes taking communion and keeping peace orderly. God likes hearing our spontaneous prayers. God definitely wants us to have decent coffee after the service. I knew I'd get a few amens at the end of that. It's human nature to want to put God's blessing behind our own personal preferences. The challenge, of course, is this makes us highly resistant to new things. We like being comfortable. And new things tend to involve a bit of discomfort. And God wouldn't want us to be uncomfortable, would he? So given all this, how on earth can God possibly put a new song on our lips? Well, it's time to turn to our psalm and to consider what insights it might have to offer. Psalm 40 opens with this truly wonderful image. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the desolate pit, out of the miry bog, and set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. It's a really fantastically wonderful image of a person being in a difficult spot and of God lifting them up and not only rescuing them from their peril, but placing their feet on a firm place. We read that this act of deliverance by God causes a new song to be placed in the psalmist's mouth. Now you might think, given a person having an experience of being dramatically rescued from peril, that they would turn naturally to an old song, that they would sing perhaps with new gusto given what has just happened. And yet we read a new song is put on their lips. In responding to what's happened, they're praising God in a new way. And this song seems to be inviting the psalmist into a deeper level in their relationship with God. We read in verse 6 that they're no longer content with familiar rituals. Rather, this new song prompts a fresh outpouring of praise that comes not from performing outward actions, but from deep within their heart. For the psalmist, the law is no longer written on a scroll, but it's put upon their heart, as verse 8 testifies. And this new song just compels the psalmist to speak out and to proclaim boldly, I have not hidden your saving help within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. And I think in our psalm there's some helpful insights as we consider how to respond and how to look to God putting a new song on our lips. As we've seen in previous weeks in our season of praise, if you've been following along, a major theme of the Psalms is the importance of looking back, of remembering of what God has done in the past. And our voice of praise gets refreshed when we remember all that God has done for us. Psalm 40 reminds us that this looking back should also encourage us as we look to the future. We look back not out of a sense of wanting to hold on to the past or to simply wallow in nostalgia, but in order to help open us up to what God is doing now and what God is going to do into the future. We can praise God with confidence now based on what's happened in the past, but also with a sense of anticipation for what God is going to do moving into the future. As I said earlier, the church finds itself in a challenging place. It's all too easy for us to look back and remember how good things were for the church in times gone by and perhaps despair a little at how much has changed. We can easily make the mistake of thinking that because the church was stronger in the past, then that's where God is to be found. But our God is not just the God of the past. He's the God of the here and the now, and he's the God of the future. It's wonderful to sing old songs that help us fondly recall times from our past in our relationship with God, particular high points. But we also need to learn how to let God put a new song on our lips so we can look forward to what is to come in the future. With all of this, it's really worth taking a bit of a leaf out of church history, and especially its relationship with church music. And this sort of became a bit of a theme when I was looking at preparing this sermon. And I really enjoyed reading back into church history, and I was reminded of how many times new things musically happened in the church and the people who opposed it. Early singing in the church took the form of plain song chant. And in France, they happened to hit upon this idea of introducing the idea of harmony into this, which enabled these simple chants to be split into different parts. But breaking the chant up into two, three, or even four parts didn't please everyone, and we've got historical records of critics of this suggesting that the introduction of harmony into church is introducing lewdness into church. Again, the introduction of musical instruments was strongly resisted because musical instruments were associated with frivolity, debauchery, immorality, and it's hard to imagine nowadays for our 9 o'clock congregation especially, who are particularly love our church organ, that organs, when they were first introduced, were seen as worldly instruments that had absolutely no place in a sacred space such as a church. Initially, of course, it was just people up the front who sang. The idea that the congregation should sing was also a bit of a radical development, but reformers such as Martin Luther used it to their advantage. For them, they saw it in a day when much of the congregation was illiterate and didn't have much knowledge of the Bible and theology. If you wrote hymns with great theology behind it, what a great way to impart that to the congregation. And so that's what Martin Luther did. He spent a lot of time writing new words to popular songs of the time that would enable the congregation to take the theology home with them. Again, some resisting, saying church music needs to be different from the kind of music we're hearing out on the streets. I think when you think about those lessons from history, it encourages us to have a little bit more of a humble attitude. I think it helps us to resist the temptation to theologize our personal preferences in order to quash new things that might be happening in our church. And as I reflected back on this, I was really reminded, this idea of singing a new song, how strongly changes and developments in music are associated historically with the great revivals in the church. It's interesting, we talk about Martin Luther and the Reformation and one of the key revivals in the church. We think about the English revival under John and Charles Wesley, great hymn writers. We think about the Salvation Army, who took the music of the churches out to the masses and went where the people were. We think about our more recent charismatic revival, which is riding on a wave of contemporary worship music. I think we need to be nuanced in our approach. I don't think the psalmist is suggesting a simplistic stance of the old is bad and the new therefore is good. The old still has a lot to offer, and the new isn't good simply because it's new. We need discernment. The traditions of the church have much to offer to help guide us into the future, but these traditions shouldn't be used to prevent us from trying new things. I think it's also worth remembering, often we can be a bit despondent perhaps about the state of the church in relation to modern society, but it's just interesting that there are many areas of society that are struggling with how to stay relevant in a rapidly changing world. I was just reading this week, some of you know the broadcaster Waleed Ali, and he did the Andrew Olley Memorial Lecture, which is given every year, reflecting on the state of journalism. And he in particular was encouraging his audience, which are largely made up of journalists, about wrestling with this great challenge that journalists have now, where they're in this digital age that we live in, their old funding models of the rivers of gold through the classified ads and the selling of physical newspapers has just collapsed. And we've seen this across the media, these new ways that are rising up. How do journalists wrestle with the idea of trying to dig deep, of telling the truth and of conveying meaning in their stories when their editors are looking for profits all the time and they're encouraged to do things in a way, and you would have heard that term clickbait. That's all what The Age, for example, which is one of our great newspapers here in Melbourne, has just seemingly gone to slush, where its website is just full of all these ways of trying to get you to click on something that when you click on it, you think, what was the point of that in the first place? Many institutions, many, are struggling to stay relevant. It's really tough. We within the church have this fantastic advantage that God is with us as we take this journey. Another facet of this challenge is that we live in a consumer culture where it's a culture of choice, where the consumer is always right. We're encouraged to shop around to get what we want. And this has impacted on all aspects of life, including our attitude to the church. Some of it good, in that the church needs to be relevant and engaging. We kind of expect that we should be able to get something out of our church services. We no longer live in a society where people just rock up to church just because that's seen as the right thing to do. People want to get something out of the experience, and that's good. We have to be careful, of course, that this consumer attitude doesn't overwhelm our attitude to worship. I didn't get much out of that service, you might hear people say over coffee. Not in this church, obviously, but if you visit other churches, you know, I didn't get much out of this. You know, I didn't get much out of this. The psalmist is inviting us to consider not what we got out of it, but what did we give? Not what did God do for us, but what did we bring before God? The Bible is the story of God's relationship with his people. And one of the features, if you look at the biblical narrative as a whole, is the number of times God does something new. And as we've been reminded, we're in the season of Advent when God is doing something radically new, sending his Son into the world. And one of the stories that can be read at this time is the story of Simeon, who was a devout elderly Jewish man who worked in the temple. And God had promised Simeon that he wouldn't die until his eyes had seen the much longed for and much hoped for Messiah. Mary and Joseph bring the baby Jesus to the temple as part of the Jewish purification ritual. And Simeon sees Jesus and he realizes that in this baby, God's promise has been fulfilled. Simeon takes Jesus in his arms and he says something for a Jewish person which is profound and incredible. "Master, now you are dismissing your servant in peace according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all peoples, a light of revelation to the Gentiles and for the glory of your people Israel." Here's this temple person who's steeped in Jewish traditions realizing that in this baby, God is doing something radically new. This message, which the Jewish people have taken as their own, is now going to go out to all people, Jews and Gentiles, to all nations. Simeon starts singing a new song. We must become the change that we want to see in the church. If we want the church to sing a new song and engage in fresh ways with people, then each one of us has to learn how to sing a new song. This is going to take some humility, a willingness to try new things, a willingness perhaps to be made a little bit uncomfortable every now and again. But if verse 10 of Psalm 40 is going to be our prayer, then this is what it will take. We don't want to have this love that we know, this great love of God for us, to be hidden in our hearts, for this place to just sort of gently fade away over the years as more and more of us pass away. We want this to be a vibrant place where this new song keeps going out. We want to echo that cry of the psalmist. "I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation." We're going to finish in a different way today, and we're going to take up this challenge immediately. And can I express my thanks to Mark for being willing to do this? One of the things being preaching every now and again is that you get asked by the service leader, "Have you got any suggestions for what song should be sung?" And normally my answer, being not terribly musical, is no idea. So this time, however, because it was Psalm 40, there was an obvious song for sing. And that is, for those of you who know your U2, it's their version of this particular psalm. And so I said to Mark, "It'd be great if we could sing Psalm 40. Mark had 2.5 hours at Emmanuel Church yesterday, got an Advent Carol service tonight, has lots on at this time of the year. But in the spirit of being willing to sing a new song, I thank Mark very much for being willing to take up the musical challenge. Let's stand and sing Psalm 40, a new song on our lips.
Patiently for the Lord, he climbed, heard my cry, brought me up out of the pit and of the miry clay. I will sing a new song. I will sing a new song." Let's go for the top. Patiently for the Lord, he climbed and heard my cry, brought me up out of the pit, out of the miry clay. I will sing a new song. I will sing a new song. set my feet upon a rock, made my footsteps firm. Many will see, and many will see and hear. I will sing, sing a new song. I will sing.
I will sing.